Good morning, friends. It's really a treat for me to be with you. People keep asking me to preach in various places, and it's a little surprising to me. I come from a family of preachers. My father is a fine preacher. My sister is a fine preacher. My grandfather was a preacher as well. I spent most of my life as a long-haired folk singer. And my favorite comment I ever got after a sermon was in Raleigh. I was standing at the door shaking hands and talking to people a little bit, and a woman was leaving and she said, "Thank you for that sermon," or whatever you call that. So, whatever we call it, let us humbly, as people who are seeking to be faithful, trying to figure out what it means to follow, let's take a look at this really familiar text and see if it has anything else to say to us this morning. Before I get into that, though, I need to say a word about politics here in the church. Now, there are many folks who say you should never talk about politics in church. I want to say that I stand firmly among those folks by one definition of politics. But we have multiple definitions of politics, and we tend to weave back and forth between them. So one definition of politics is the mud fight between political parties. And I agree that if we preach in the service of a political party, we are the tool of something that is probably not God. However, the word politics has a deeper and broader meaning, which is a system, any system by which any group of people tries to decide together what matters and who matters and what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. And if we refuse to address those questions, we are not being faithful to the teachings of Jesus. So the one kind of politics we should not speak of in church, and the other kind of politics we should never refrain from speaking of in church. I just wanted to be clear about that before we march forward here together. I was given leeway on what verses to preach on, and I thought, goodness, I've got this one moment with this group of people, and I don't know if I'll ever get to have another conversation with them. What in the world should I say? What's the main thing? If I've just got this one little window, what do I bring? And I went to the New Testament and I thought, wow, you know, that a very similar question was asked of Jesus one time. What's the main thing? What's the greatest commandment? And that story is told actually in three of the four Gospels, and there are minor variations among the three. In some, Jesus just answers the question. In others, he says, "What do you read in the text?" And the questioner answers his own question. Jesus says, "That's the right answer." The question is a little different in places. In one place, it's, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" In another, it's, "What is the greatest commandment?" But the answer is the same, consistently. And the answer is, love God and love your neighbor. So in this text this morning, this lawyer, whose job it is to clarify things, right? I mean, that's a worthy calling, to clarify things, right? And he says, okay, what exactly do you mean by neighbor? And this leads us to the story of the Good Samaritan, as we call it. Although the word good is never in that text. We've named it that. I think perhaps it should be the kind Samaritan. But I'll get back to that. So this command we're given as the main thing. The main thing. Why is it that at football games we hold up John 3:16 and we don't hold up Luke 10:27? Jesus said this is the main thing. That's what he said. So the lawyer says, "Who's my neighbor? What exactly do you mean by neighbor? If you want me to love my neighbor, who is that?" Valid question, and it leads to a good story. But I sometimes wish that the lawyer had instead asked the other really obvious question, which is, what exactly do you mean by love? Because that's a word we toss around a lot, right? In our daily life, and certainly in church, we talk a lot about love. And the word love, kind of like the word politics, has so many different meanings. I love my wife, and I love my son, and I love my mom. In three completely different ways, right? But I would argue that I was discussing yesterday with this group from those of you who are here from First Press Charlotte, the fact that I think our most common usage of the word love is just extreme like. Right? I love French fries. Right? And I don't think that's what Jesus was talking about. The actual text here says, if you take it back to Hebrew, the text reads as chesed, the word for love. And that's a legal term that was used in treaties between kings. In terms of how they were going to treat each other. Kings that had had tensions with each other, perhaps wars and violence. When they signed a peace treaty, they said they would treat each other with chesed, which means I will look out for your best interests. You will be my ally. I will care for you. I will treat you like my own. It's not a feeling at all. It's a statement of policy. Here's how I'm going to treat you. Sometimes in spite of how I feel and not because of how I feel. It's kind of radical to suggest that love is not a feeling. But in this text, it's not. And that influences a lot of our reading of this, I think, or at least of my reading of it. So the Good Samaritan story is one of the best known stories in the Bible. We've all heard it. We've heard it referred to many times. It's the name of a travel club. It's kind of everywhere. The Good Samaritan. It's a common reference even for people who don't share the faith that we're exploring this morning. And the lawyer wants to clarify when he hears this story. Who's my neighbor? Does that mean the folks who live next door? Does that mean the folks I worship with at the temple? Does it mean the folks I carpool to work with? People in my political party? How far does this neighbor thing go? And in response, Jesus did what he so often did. I sometimes wonder if he was from Appalachia because he was asked a very direct question. He said, well, let me tell you a story. And he told a good story. And this story has changed for me over the course of my life. The way I understood it as a child, I now understand it completely differently. Partly because I've learned a little bit more about what a Samaritan is. I did a little reading about this, and I want to share an excerpt from a book, just a couple paragraphs, to give us some context. It's a book by Mark Powell. He wrote a textbook called Introducing the New Testament, a Historical, Literary, and Theological Survey, and this is in chapter 1. He says this, Samaritans and Jews were both descended from Jacob, but after the death of Solomon, tensions arose between the north and south, and the kingdom split in two, so there's a civil war. The Samaritans claimed that they were the true Israel, who were descendants of the 10 lost tribes taken into Assyrian captivity. They had their own temple on Mount Gerizim and claimed that it was the original sanctuary. Moreover, they claimed that their version of the Pentateuch, of the Torah, was the original, and that the Jews had a falsified text produced by Ezra during the Babylonian exile. So we've got the real Bible and yours is fake. We've got the real temple and yours is fake. Likewise, the Jews looked at it this way. The term kuthim, applied by the Jews to the Samaritans, had clear pejorative connotations, implying that they were interlopers brought in from Kutha in Mesopotamia and rejecting their claim of descent from the ancient tribes of Israel. So your temple is fake, your text is fake, your faith is fake, your news is fake, you're fake. You are not truly the people of God. We are. That's what the Samaritans were saying to the Jews, and that's what the Jews were saying to the Samaritans. So people listening to Jesus' story would have felt gut-level revulsion at the mention of a Samaritan. They were literally prohibited from talking to one another or being within each other's territory. They would have seen each other at a distance, but they never would have had a conversation. It's the perfect way to dehumanize somebody. Keep them where you can kind of see them, but never have a human interaction, and be filled with stories about who they are and who they are not. So what about the other characters in the story? We know who the Samaritan would be to the listeners of Jesus' story in his time. The folks who walk by to the other side of the road, well, of course, we've got the Levite, who is a revered church leader. The Levites were charged with caring for the Ark of the Covenant. They were really important people, right? And he walked to the other side. And of course, likewise, the priest, a respected church leader, both choose not to interact with the man in the ditch. Jesus chooses two religious leaders in this story who are too married to their rules and perhaps their prestige to obey the law, the greatest commandment of loving each other. So there's statute, in my understanding, and there's law. Law is the big thing. Love God, love each other. And then all the statutes are how we interpret that. How do we try to do that? And then sometimes we get so hung up on our statutes that we disregard or undermine the law. What about the victim? The guy in the ditch. Here's all we know about him. We know that he was going from Jerusalem to Jericho. We know that he was robbed and stripped and beaten. We know that he was left half dead beside the road. And that's all we know. And we know more than the Samaritan did. All he knew was what he could see. And I think it's significant that the victim was stripped naked, not just because it allowed me to giggle in Sunday school when I was little, but also because he was stripped of all of his social markers. Right? You didn't know his tribe. You didn't know who he was. You didn't know if he was important, if he was unclean. And the Levite and the priest had clear rules. If they touched somebody like that, they could lose their gigs. Right? They could be utterly rejected. The cost would be very high for them. And so they don't. That's the calculation they make. Jesus so often cautioned us about being particularly attached to our rules, especially when they conflict with compassion. Compassion is a really significant word etymologically, right? It means to suffer with. To be compassionate for somebody means to be willing to share in their suffering. Here's what I'm trying to get at. As a child, I understood this as a story about being kind to people in need. Maybe going out of your way, taking some risk to interact with folks who are in trouble. That's what I thought the story was about. And if it was about that, that would be a good lesson. That would be worthy in and of itself. But this story is about so much more than that. It is so much more radical than this. Let's think it through. It would have already been completely radical if the Samaritan were the one in the ditch. The idea of touching a Samaritan would be completely offensive and countercultural. But the Samaritan is not the one in the ditch. The Samaritan is the hero of the story. Jesus takes it much, much farther than that. Again, as we talked about yesterday, it's natural to place ourselves in stories, and Jesus knew this. He was a masterful storyteller. And he's answering a question about how we are to be neighbors to each other. And he does this by telling this story and then asking, who was a neighbor here? The answer of which is obvious. And the questioner gets it right. The one who showed him mercy. To which Jesus responds, go and do likewise. I want you to go be like a Samaritan. Can you imagine how offensive that would have been to Jesus' listeners in that moment? The people you hate most in the world, I want you to go be exactly like them. It seems to me that Jesus is not telling us a story about how us is supposed to treat them. It's so much more radical than that. He's saying, look, there is no them. It's all us. I think he's trying to get that message across over and over and over again in the New Testament. You want me to be a what? Jesus is asking us not just to recognize the humanity of, but to identify with the humanity of the most reviled category of person that he can think of, to emulate them. It doesn't matter who you are, Jesus seems to be saying. It matters what you do. And when it comes to what you do, it doesn't help if you are following all the rules if those rules don't serve the law, the great commandment. Jesus is not asking us to be kind to them. He's telling us that there is no them. It's all us, Republicans and Democrats, Black Lives Matter activists and Wall Street bankers, Muslims and Christians, soldiers and peace activists. Jesus commands not that we like each other a whole lot, but that we love each other. Not that we avoid conflict, but that we approach conflict in ways that are constructive rather than destructive. Not that we are nice, but that we are kind. Not that we agree, but that we honor each other's experience and humanity. Not that we accept injustice, but that we defend each other when we are unfairly attacked. That we challenge each other in love when necessary, and hold each other and ourselves accountable without ever yielding to hatred. Not so much that we call each other out, but that we call each other in. There's a difference between like and love. These are not points on a continuum of affection, but rather fundamentally different things. Anyone who's been committed in a long-term relationship, whether that's your family or marriage or a business partnership, you know that you can love people that you don't always like. They're different things. But in a family, you're family. And you're connected, whether you like it or not. And you try to hold each other up. You try to call each other in. I chuckle a bit when I arrive to spend some time with the church community and they say, you know, we're like a big family here. Really? Okay, so who doesn't talk to who? Like, how does that work, you know? Interesting, right. It's not an unfair description to say that we are called to be family as children of God. The family that is born of being children of God includes all of us. And I want to just remember, as we close out this thinking together, the whole Good Samaritan story is in response to a clarifying question about the great commandment. Love God and love each other. All of the law and all of the prophets hang on these two, Jesus says. Everything we do, every decision we make, must be filtered through this. And transformation for all of us comes in the context of relationship. We very seldom reject each other into making more compassionate decisions. We love each other into positive change. I live over on Cragmont Road in Black Mountain, and I've lived there for over 20 years. When I moved into that little house, there were no sidewalks in the neighborhood, and a few people would walk along the road, but it was really dangerous to walk along the road, so most people didn't. We drove in and out of our houses, our driveways, and didn't really talk to each other much. And then at some point, the town put in a sidewalk. And it was amazing to watch within weeks the community start to grow. Because people were walking their dogs, and the kids were playing, and you start talking to each other, and you start knowing your neighbors. It's an amazing thing. And I've treasured that about my community over the years, that we kind of know each other and we like each other mostly, and it's all right. It all kind of works out. 2 years ago, after the election that happened then, I felt like they had come to my neighborhood and torn out all the sidewalks. People were afraid to talk to each other. And I got so frustrated by this. My neighbors, who I loved, who voted lots of different ways, I wanted them to know, look, if your car battery dies, you can knock on my door, no matter who you voted for. We are community. I thought, I just want to put a sign on my house because people aren't talking to each other. I just want to say to my neighbors, look, it's okay. And I said this to my wife, and then I thought, you know, actually, I could do that. I could actually put a sign on my house. And I talked to her about it, and we talked about what the sign might say. And we decided we'd like to do that. So we talked to my son about it, and he wasn't so sure at first, but we chatted about it a little bit, and he decided that he wanted to do that too. And so we put a sign on our house that says, "You are our neighbors. No matter who you vote for, your skin color, who you love, where you're from, we will try to be here for you. That's what community means. Let's be neighbors." The sign is 8 feet tall. And it's been on my house for a while. And now it's hanging on churches and houses across the country. It's hanging on Abraham Lincoln's church in Springfield, Illinois. Bigger than on my house. I think we are called to be neighbors to each other. To love each other. Not just to like each other. And this is the good news. That this circle, God's circle, holds all of us. The wholeness of God's creation is not the illusion. The separation within it is the illusion. We are all welcome, and we are called to welcome each other. As challenging as that can be, to go out of our way to care for, defend, and protect each other, and together to heal. Go and do likewise.